Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. There's a new twist to an epic territorial dispute between Japan and China. Japan's government plans to nationalize a group of tiny, uninhabited islands in the East China Sea that separates the two countries. Japanese newspapers are reporting this week that the government will pay the Japanese family that owns the islands about 2 billion yen, or $26 million. The problem is, China claims ownership to the islands, called Diaoyu in China and Senkaku in Japan. The dispute has simmered for generations and occasionally boils over, as it did a few weeks ago when activists from both countries pulled stunts that prompted large demonstrations in China. The Reuters news agency says the reported sale will likely fuel more tensions between Asia's two largest economies. No one lives on the rocky outcrops, but deep below the surrounding fishing areas are potentially rich gas deposits. But overall, this dispute is more than just about money. Later in the program, we'll hear from Martin Fackler, the Tokyo bureau chief of the New York Times, and Sheila Smith from the Council of Foreign Relations. But now joining us by phone from Tokyo is Linda Sieg. She's the chief correspondent for Reuters. Welcome to Global Journalist.
Hi. Hi. Nice to be here.
Glad to have you. Earlier on the program, I talked with Martin Fackler, the Tokyo bureau chief of the New York Times, and Sheila Smith from the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, Linda, how is China reacting to the reported sale?
Well, China is angry, expressing anger over the plan by the Prime Minister and his government to purchase the island. The recent reports that the purchase is going through are not the first time that China has become aware of this. It came up several weeks ago when the Prime Minister floated the plan, basically in response to another plan by the governor of Tokyo, Shintaro Ishihara, who is well known as a harsh critic of China. And his proposal was for his metropolitan government of Tokyo to buy the islands. So in point of fact, although China says they own them and therefore no one in Japan should, no part of the government should be buying them, in a way, the Japanese central government was trying to come up with a less inflammatory way of coping with the situation.
So on the surface, it seems like that the government's doing something aggressive and anti-Chinese, but in essence, this could be a good thing for their relations.
Well, it would be a good thing if China would perceive it that way. I think we can assume that there are back channels that the Japanese government is trying to explain that. I know the Deputy Prime Minister made comments to journalists today saying that, you know, the intention is to have a stable situation, not to inflame the situation.
And let's put this dispute in some historical context. China says the islands have been its territory since the 14th century when they first appeared on Chinese maps during the Ming Dynasty. Japan claims it discovered the islands in 1884 and annexed them 9 years later after winning the first Sino-Japanese War. China counters that it was forced to sign the post-war treaty that effectively handed the islands over to Japan. And then the United States took control of the islands after World War II, but transferred them back to Japan in 1972. So this is quite a long history, this dispute. How is this this latest news playing in the Japanese newspapers? Is it front page news?
It is often front page news. I think as you say, it flares up periodically. This time it flared up first when the governor of Tokyo made his proposal to buy the islands. It comes, however, in a context, the context in which, you know, relations become tense because of the dispute tend to change somewhat over time. It is probably more of an issue now in Japan because of China's economic and military and diplomatic rise both globally and regionally. So it comes in the context of, you know, kind of Japan feeling a sense of decline, or you might say threat, from China at the same time that China is feeling, you know, more self-confident, or you might even say aggressive. It comes at the same time, for example, as disputes in the South China Sea between China and Southeast Asian nations.
And besides the
China,
right. And besides those geopolitical implications, there's some financial implications as well, aren't there? I know Reuters did an in-depth story recently on the impact of these somewhat soured relations on car sales. Can you explain that to us?
Right. Well, a Nissan Motor executive said today, speaking to reporters in China, that they were seeing, to use his words, some impact on Japanese car sales in China. It's probably a bit hard to quantify exactly what that impact is because it also comes at the time of a somewhat of a slowdown in the Chinese economy. But I think the point is that, an important point is that this is precisely the impact that neither side really wants to see. They don't want, neither Beijing nor Tokyo, the central governments, want to see any sort of significant damage to what are very mutually interdependent economic ties. The problem is that if the central governments share that concern, they both face domestic political pressure and not to look weak-kneed, not to look as if they're giving in to the other side because of public mistrust and because, particularly in the case of China, the legacy of the bitter history in the past, which even young people have been educated to know about.
Right. Now, looking ahead, do you see this dispute over these tiny islands getting worse or getting better? What would what's your gut feeling tell you on this?
I think that's a very difficult question to answer. I might even quote to you the president of Fast Retailing Company in Japan, which is the maker of the Uniqlo line of casual apparel, was speaking to Reuters earlier this week, and he is expanding there. His company is expanding in China, opening more stores. And what his quote sort of sums it up. He said, "It seems hard to read the future." That's partly because Japan is going through a very unstable political situation at the time. There will probably be an election within months. China is also facing a leadership change next month, once in a decade leadership change, and they're really devoting their primary energies and political capital to the domestic situation. So it makes it difficult, I think, to predict to what extent this can, in fact, be kept from getting out of hand, even if one assumes that, you know, the top leaders would prefer it to calm it down.
Okay. Well, Linda, I really appreciate you taking the time today to join our program.
Okay. Well, it's a pleasure.
Thank you very
much. Thank you.
Now joining us on Global Journalist are two other experts on the region. Sheila A. Smith is a senior fellow for Japan Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, and she's on the phone from Washington. Martin Fackler is the Tokyo Bureau Chief of the New York Times. He's been covering the China Sea issues with a focus on the relationship between China and Japan. Welcome to Global Journalist.
Hello, David.
Thank you.
Martin, tell us about what kind of sparked this latest flare-up in this long-running dispute.
Well, David, I think it's kind of a... you know, to try to find the beginnings is a bit of a chicken and egg sort of issue. But
start with the one of the dynasties. No,
right.
Of the past few months. Yeah,
I would say it. Yeah, the broader beginning would be this clash 2 years ago over the Chinese trawler captain who was arrested after his ship rammed a Japanese Coast Guard vessel. And it set off this sort of prickliness and I think in Japan an awareness of China was a more and more assertive presence. And a feeling in Japan that Japan had to defend its interests more and to do more to claim sovereignty. So that's kind of the broader background.
Right.
But the more proximate cause and the more immediate cause actually has been activists from both sides, not the national governments. I would say the most recent round probably began with Tokyo Governor Ishihara Shintaro's idea of buying three of the islands in the chain. The islands are actually owned by a private citizen, a Japanese national who lives in suburban Tokyo. And Governor Ishihara wanted to buy them because he wanted to make a stronger assertion of Japanese claims. And mm-hmm. basically it was a criticism of the current government as being too weak-kneed on foreign policy. And Ishihara's plan was to build some sort of structures on the island and on the islands and make a stronger Japanese claim. And this set off a chain of events, one of the biggest of which was 14 Chinese activists from Hong Kong who staged a landing on the island, on one of the islands, in August. Seven of them actually made it onto the island. All 14 were arrested, they were detained,
right,
and then deported. And the deportation was significant because it was Japan's effort to defuse things. I mean, the national governments actually have been fairly calm relative to these activists who are keep sort of stirring things up. And then on the Japanese side, the deportation of the Chinese prompted a small flotilla of fishing boats from an island called Ishigaki to go to the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands. Something like 100 or 150 people are on board these vessels. Of them, a very small number actually landed on one of the islands and, you know, waved flags and this sort of thing.
And Sheila, what are you noticing about the difference in coverage in China and Japan?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I get invited to be on various media outlets, and I have been asked many times in the last week or so by China, by CCTV, their English station, by their reporters, magazines, as well as print media, to comment on this and what's going on in Japan, and what do you think about the central government, the national government of Tokyo is trying, national government of Japan wants to purchase these islands to, again, as Martin said, keep it low key so it can control access to the islands more effectively. So there's a lot of Chinese interest in trying to interpret what's going on in Japan. There's also, I think, a significant amount of Chinese media attention to the fact that these latest series of incidents has produced a lot of demonstrations in China and a fairly, strong domestic debate that's very anti-Japanese. So I sense in the media coverage by the Chinese that are approaching me, for example, that they really want a kind of analytical perspective. They want to calm it down, give it some logic, talk it through a little bit more. On the Japanese side, I think the media is, let's just say in the spring when Governor Ishihara came to Washington and made the speech at the Heritage Foundation, which is a think tank here in D.C., the Japanese media was somewhat skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, you know, basically the governor had made that speech in Tokyo, it probably wouldn't have got as much attention as it did.
Okay.
So the media has played a kind of, I think in both cases, I'm somewhat surprised by the kind of tone that I'm hearing in my interaction with the media. But inside both countries, I think there's a tendency to highlight this issue as a test of sovereignty and a kind of, you know, this is not all or nothing, but there's a little bit of a, you know, just how far does this need to go? Inside Japan, I find there is today a mood of vulnerability and a certain amount of conservative exploitation of that public mood. And I would say that that's a little bit
the tone and the tenor of the media coverage that I'm hearing in Japanese.
Vulnerability because China's getting to be so much more dominant.
Exactly. This is a China, and in fact, I'm just finishing up a book on this, that this is a rising China. It's a China that over the last decade, successive Japanese governments, conservative and liberal reform as well, have had a very hard time managing. There's been a lot of episodes of contention, you know, from the controversial, you know, issue of Yasukuni shrine visits by Prime Minister Koizumi back early 2000 to East China Sea issues, to resource issues, to gyoza, food poisoning emanating from imports from China, and then this latest Senkaku series of tensions. So I think you have a public in Japan that's much more sensitive to its own vulnerability to this rising China.
Right. And Martin, would you agree about the coverage being somewhat toned down and trying to avoid escalation?
Yes, I would agree, Sheila, because it's interesting. I think the governments have been trying in this most recent round not to let things escalate. And I don't think they're being, that emotions are being driven by major media, at least not in Japan. I don't watch China as closely, but in Japan, I don't get the sense that the major media are behind it. What's interesting from a media perspective is I think a lot of the emotions are taking place on new media, on the internet, on chat rooms. This vulnerability that Sheila correctly pointed out, I think it expresses itself on, they have these chat rooms in Japan, the most popular which is called Nichanaru, which is a very, it's like young, you know, people in their 20s and 30s who are basically sounding off about, you know, angrily about China, and there can be a very sort of nationalistic and emotional mood on these things. And so I think it's interesting how that it seems to be more in that space where you get a lot of the emotions on that side. And I think on the Chinese side, my feeling from talking with my Chinese colleagues is that the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands are much more, they're probably much more emotional they're emotional on both sides, but in China, the emotions have a lot to do with history,
right,
in the sense of the islands are seen as kind of the first step of Japan's aggression towards China a century ago.
Right.
When you hear sort of the Chinese presentation of the problem, it's usually that these islands were the first thing that Japan sees before then seizing Taiwan and then moving into China and so on and so forth. So they're seen as kind of a first step of Japanese imperialism. And the fact that Japan hasn't relinquished the islands, this is the Chinese view, right?
Right.
Is then seen as a sign that somehow Japan is unrepentant, that somehow we get back to this idea that Japan hasn't apologized, which, I mean, it really has apologized, but you get this notion that because Japan hasn't relinquished these islands, you know, what really is at stake is Japan's view towards history, right? And somehow Japan hasn't really, you know, come to terms with the pain that it inflicted on China. So I think that's why these, you know, bird-dropping covered rocks out in the middle of the ocean become such an important issue. I mean, it is about energy issue.
Right.
So there is that aspect. But I think it's about history and grievance and a sense of past wrongs, you know, that really becomes very, very powerful and very volatile. And that's sort of the risk that we have with this issue, is that volatility.
Right. And let's bring the United States into this. Sheila, first, from your point of view, what's at stake for the U.S. and what can the government do to help and not to hinder this dispute?
Well, I think, first of all, the State Department's position on the dispute over the sovereignty of the islands is that the United States doesn't take sides in the dispute itself. But you saw in the crisis of 2010, where you had the fishing trawler captain that ran into the Japanese Coast Guard vessels and was arrested, in that management of that sort of escalating diplomatic confrontation between Tokyo and Beijing, you had the foreign minister of Japan at the time, Maihara Seiji, meet with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and she reiterated the fact that the United States understood that these islands were under Japanese administration, and therefore they fell under Article 5 protections of the bilateral security treaty between the United States and Japan. Now, that was not the first time the U.S. government had pointed that out publicly. Deputy Secretary of State Rich Armitage had done that when he was working in the Bush administration. Well, but 2 points on this that are probably pretty important to share. And one is that Japanese, especially the Ministry of Foreign Affairs officials, have long sort of chafed under that interpretation by the United States. In other words, the U.S. was an ally, but they didn't take a position on the dispute. And part of that is because if you go back to right after World War II, then the San Francisco Peace Treaty that the United States guided through the process with a number of other states that allowed Japan, again, to regain sovereignty. The islands were part of Japan then, and the United States said that they were part of Japan when they reverted them back to Japanese sovereignty. So there's a kind of frustration, I think, among Japanese diplomats that the United States takes this rather vague, we don't take a side in the dispute, although historically the United States certainly did acknowledge this was Japanese territory. Similarly, when you talk to Chinese, you get a kind of reversal. Several of the interviews that I did over the last couple of weeks with the Chinese television, they said, why are the Americans dedicated to stirring up this problem between Japan and China? So they perceived the United States as a very active participant, and they referred to military exercises that our military had been doing with the Japanese, which was an island defense amphibious landing.
Recently, yeah. That was fairly recently, right?
This was interpreted, right, as some kind of direct intervention by the United States. So again, the American role is very sensitive here on both sides.
And Martin, you recently, in an article, mentioned that Japan is redrawing its national defense strategy to push back at China. How is that happening?
Well, two years ago, there was a significant redrawing of strategy. It's something that's been building for a long time, but it was presented as this shift from north to south. And it got a lot of play in the local media as this sort of dramatic rethinking of military strategy. And basically the idea was that Japanese military thinking had been still in the Cold War, that they had focused a lot of ground troops and tanks and heavy weapons in Hokkaido, the northernmost island, to defend against an invasion from the Soviet Union, which, of course, hasn't existed for many years. So, and this was, in a way, a belated shifting of priorities where they would go towards a more mobile force, Navy, amphibious, and air-based, to defend to the south and to remote islands in the south. And this was, of course, very much directed at China. China's the only country that's really pressing against Japan in the south. I guess Taiwan is there as well, but they're not really as assertive. So there has been, I think, this shift in thinking in Japan towards trying to do more to defend its interests. And there's a broader, I think there's two sort of trends of thinking here. One is the notion that Japan, and this may be because of the anxiety, that Japan needs to do more to on its own. Traditionally, Japan had relied on the U.S. to do things. It relied on the American nuclear umbrella and these sorts of things, and had taken a very low profile in diplomatic issues and in national security issues. And I think you're seeing more and more calls for Japan to do more, and it can be in the context of the U.S. alliance, where Japan, for example, will share more of the responsibilities, or it can also be presented as Japan acting on its own and increasing its own capability. So that's something that you're definitely seeing here, which is it's kind of a rethinking of, you know, that Japan no longer has the luxury, in a sense, of just sort of sitting back and letting the U.S. take care of things, that the world has changed and that Japan has to find a way to stand up for itself. And that's what drives a lot of these activists to speak, because they feel that Japan's too passive, Japan can't say no, it can't speak its mind. And so when you read the domestic sort of narratives about what's happening, they're usually presented as Japan has to stand up to the world, it has to make itself known. The other interesting thing that you see, especially with conservatives in Japan, is a feeling that the U.S. won't be there in a dispute over the islands. I see over and over again in like for example, the weekly tabloids, which are in some ways a good, you know, way to get insight into at least, you know, how middle-aged Japanese men are thinking. But they, the emotional buttons that the tabloids are pushing tend to be, you know, the Chinese are challenging us, the Chinese are kind of mocking us, making fun of us, and the Americans won't be there to protect us, that they're, you know, they're not going to protect the senkakus for us, you know, and we need to do it on our own. And so you are getting, I think, a shifting feeling in Japan of what they need to do and what their position is. Now, having said that, this is, I'm not saying that Japan is, you know, trying to revive its imperial ambitions or anything. It's nothing like that. But I think it's rather just a feeling that Japan needs to do more to protect what it already has, to protect its current lines, if you will, the territorial lines. And at the same time, it needs to be more assertive on its own. So it's an interesting sort of trend that's still unfolding.
Now, before we continue our discussion, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. This week we have an interactive map of the South China, or both the South China Sea and the East China Sea, and an interactive timeline of flare-ups in the long-standing dispute. So please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org. Or you can go to our Facebook page and or follow us on Twitter at GJJournalist. Sheila, I wanted to ask you, what if some Chinese activists plant the flag, so to speak, on this island and try to occupy it and force the issue? What do you see as happening then?
The Japanese are very sensitive to the fact that something could go wrong inadvertently, right, in the interactions. These are islands that are, you know, far, far away from any other piece of land. This last incident, the Japanese government put police on the ground in addition to the Japanese Coast Guard circling and surrounding the waters. To date, the Japanese Coast Guard has not had the authority to arrest. They can stop, they can inspect, but they don't have policing authority on land, which is an interesting administrative sort of barrier here to the thinking about this issue. On this incident with activists, what you have the potential for is some kind of harm to come. Somebody drowns, somebody, you know, dies in the context of one of these incidents. And then I think the emotional reaction, both in China and in Japan, is going to be much, much more intense. So the Coast Guard, I think, have their work cut out for them. They have to be very calm in the management of these incidences, and the Japanese police and others will probably be put on the scene to help.
In our final few seconds, Martin, what do you think the odds are that this could go bad and that there could be a worst-case scenario that's driven by the emotions and the nationalist feelings?
Well, I think, as Sheila said, that the risk is someone gets killed or something happens and this sets off street demonstrations or this sort of thing. I would say that Japan and China did set up better sort of back channels after government-to-government back channels after the 2010 clash. So they have an effort to improve that. So there are positive signs as well.
We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Our program is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. An Chi Du is our lead producer. Join us again next week for another Global Journalist. Thank you.